a candy bar commercial or a cereal commercial is producing your movie, your joint might be whacked. Just like, it might be whacked.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
Well, welcome back. Glad to have you back here again. Another episode of Story and Craft. You make it so much fun. So, you know, thank you so much for coming back by. And if this is your very first entry into the world of Story and Craft, I welcome you with open arms. And thank you so much for checking out the show. Today, sitting down with a guy, I got to tell you, he's one of those people who you meet and you go, you know, there are still other people out in the world who they come from a place or a background and a point of view. And it's like, thank goodness he's out there doing his thing. Johnny Ray Gill, you can see him right now. Season 2 of Cross on Prime Video. You can see him right now. Great character, great actor. He's a writer, creative, just a really interesting guy. You know, we talk a little food, as we always do. We talk spoken Spanish a tiny bit. You know, it's just a very well-rounded episode. I think you'll really enjoy it. And if you haven't had an opportunity to get introduced to Johnny Ray Gill, well, you know, sit back, relax. You'll enjoy the chat. Hey, do me a favor, if you would, I always ask humbly, make sure whatever podcast app you use, and we're on all of them, just go ahead and click follow. Make sure to follow Story and Craft. Like the show. Leave a comment. It really does help people to find Story and Craft. You can also check out the official website, storyandcraftpod.com. And we're on Substack. We're Substacking it. All about supporting independent media. And they're doing a great job. Great repository of just cool stuff. Just go to storyandcraft.substack.com. And we're right there. Tell you what. You're going to enjoy this conversation. Johnny Ray Gill, just a good dude. And to me, that's kind of the highest honor. I mean, just a good dude. Think about the last person you referred to, and they're a good dude. You know, you felt it. They're a solid citizen. He's got a lot going on. Great conversation, and I think you'll enjoy it. So let's do it today. Johnny Ray Gill Day, right here on Story and Craft. Where about you today? Where are you located?
I'm in L.A. right now.
I saw somewhere you were originally a Portland guy, right?
I am originally from Portland, Oregon.
You know, I way back and I say way back. It's like 10 years ago. I did a small little little miniseries thing on ABC, and there was an actor in there, and I can't remember his name, and he's from Portland. And I was like, oh, what's Portland like? He's like, if you watch Portlandia, that's pretty much what it's like. I was like, really? So is that kind of the same experience you had growing up there, or was it a little bit different?
Nah. I don't come from the Portlandia part of Portland. yeah, that's a very specific experience. But, you know, for me, I come from an all-Black community in Portland. In the Northeast area. So, you know, it's a bit different from that. But Portland has a lot of different dynamics that, you know, a lot of people in the national situation, you know, haven't got a chance to experience just yet.
Well, that's why you're here. You're here to educate us, you know.
Yes, sir.
So what kind of work did your folks do up there?
Oh, shoot, man. My mom, she was a shift leader for, they make the silicone wafers that you turn into computer chips. So she was working graveyard my entire life at this silicone, you know, I guess factory.
That's wild. I had a cousin who did that in Austin, and I guess that is that like a thing, working all night doing that, and she had to wear like that clean suit.
The clean room. Yeah, she was a shift leader, so there was definitely times I seen her in the, in the clean room suit. So she's been doing that my whole life, which wound up being a really great blessing because wherever I'm at in the world, she's kind of always on the right time zone. So she's helped wake me up to be on set many times. Helped me, you know, called me when I needed to get ready for a test in college. All those things. And my dad, he bounced around. He used to help make military trucks. Then he also worked at a place called Raven Creamery where they, you know, they made butter and all that. And then he worked at a bread factory as well. So, yeah, working class peoples.
Were you an only kid or did you have some brothers and sisters also bouncing around?
Oh, brothers and sisters. I got three sisters. Two of them are half sisters, but I don't call them that. My dad had two kids before he met my mom. So three sisters and a brother, and I'm in the middle of all of them.
Okay, so are you the only one that ended up doing the theatrical thing or the...
Yes, the I was the... Yeah, I was the first one to go into the arts. There's some artistic proclivities in the family. My sister can draw, my dad can draw, but I didn't get the draw gene. All really? I can do is do, yeah, stick figures. That's all I can do. But yeah, I was the first one to like make it official and choose it as a career.
Did your folks, like when you kind of introduced the idea of like, hey, I'm going to be doing this thing, this is kind of where I'm at. Were they receptive to it or were they like?
My mom always was. She was really about you just finding, you know, your dreams. And I did an internship. I went to a health occupations high school and they have like this, you know, you're supposed to do a health occupations internship. So I was going to do, you know, people wanted me to become an anesthesiologist, a doctor, the whole nine. And I told my mom, I was like, look, I don't think I want to do that. I started off in the arts as a spoken word poet. I started writing poetry and doing performance poetry when I was in middle school in a rites of passage program called the Perspective Gents Club. And I actually got my high school, shout out to them, to instead of letting me do the health oc internship, I was able to find a writing internship with a writer named Mike Rich. He wrote Finding Forrester, The Rookie. He wound up
really.
Yeah, he was working as a radio host, I believe, at the time. And so I reached out to him. I think I might have sent a fax. That's how long ago this was. and he was receptive. So that wound up being my internship. So those were my first kind of baby steps into the arts.
You remember you said Perspective Gents Club. Did I hear you right? Or
yes, sir.
What is that kind of like a fraternal kind of organization for writers or something? What is that?
No. It was a African based rites of passage program that centered on elevating the African American male to the status of true manhood. It's based on the African ritual of rites of passage. Most people know it stereotypically as you have to kill a lion to become a man. That's not what it is here or in Africa. But yeah, it was the largest rites of passage program west of the Mississippi in Portland, Oregon. We would have huge Kwanzaa galas in downtown Portland to celebrate the bringing in of Kwanzaa and the seven barometers of manhood, et cetera. So that program was very instrumental for my development as a young man, as an artist, as a culturally aware artist, et cetera.
Is that you said where you met this writer who was kind of like?
That was a separate situation. That was through my high school. I reached out to him. You know, like I said, I sent him an email, and this wasn't like he was doing internships. I just was a young, you know, brother that reached out and was like, "That's how you got to be."
Yeah, you're, when you're that age, you got to be like that. You know, because you got that. It's not necessarily boldness. You just don't know. Like I was the same way. I wanted to do. Yeah. I wouldn't do radio. It's like, well, I'm just going to get on the phone, call these guys. Right. You know, right. It's like, you gotta be like, Judd Apatow is one of my genius when it comes to comedy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And his whole thing was, he was just like, it's not a boldness. What is that? You just don't, you're fearless, you know,
yeah,
you just
you're go, fearless.
Why not? Yeah. And you got that when you're younger, you don't know what's at stake necessarily, or you don't really know what you don't know, which is kind of nice. Facts. Sometimes, you know? So you did the spoken word thing. So how were you comfortable up in front of people early on? Were you kind of the performer in the family, or were you shy at all when you were younger?
No, I was a jokester growing up. I never knew that would translate into the arts at all. During the rites of passage program, they would put on cultural events, and one of the cultural events, they showed a film called Slam. It won the Sundance Prize, I believe, in 1998. And Saul Williams is the title character in that. And I saw him, there's a scene in a prison and he did a poem. They were about to kill this brother. And he does a poem that is so nuts. I'll never forget the last line of it. He walks out, he goes, public enemy number one, 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 one. And there's a beat. And then all the dudes that was about to kill him, they take there's a pause and they go, I don't know what I was just thinking. I forgot. He had him entranced. And as a 14, 15-year-old kid, I said, I want to be able to do that. And that's what started my career in spoken word. And that's what took me to theater. When I got out to Philadelphia, when I went to Temple, I was performing out there, and a professor saw me performing at one of the clubs and asked me to audition for this play called Jitney. Shout out August Wilson. And that's kind of how everything started in a formal capacity.
As you're going through high school, you know, of course, you're getting these little nuggets of things that were getting your interest going, or getting your juices flowing. But was there like you know, I know the family wanted you to do the medical thing, but like, what were you wanting to do? What was there something like, you know, before you got the bug that bit you when it came to performance, what were you thinking about?
I knew I wanted to be a writer. I was writing in elementary school. I went back in some of my rhyme books and I've got like Jurassic Park 3-4 using as a short story, using my classmates as, you know, characters and things like that. So I always knew I wanted to write. I didn't know in what capacity. Also, I knew that I cared about the planet. I wanted to be a zoologist at one point. I care about the past. I wanted to be an archaeologist at one point. So those were my interests in the sciences and in the written word. And so I always just followed my interests. I never had a 9-to-5. Every time my mom made me get a job, I would quit because I would say this is a waste of time. Well, I didn't come here to work at Finish Line or to.
Yeah, isn't that kind of a feeling that you get whenever you're working a job? If it's not moving you, I was the same way. If it doesn't feel like it's moving you forward, it's not that it's menial or anything. It's just like, I can't see how I'm going to apply this. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I can see if I wanted to be a sneakerhead or if I wanted to be a shoemaker, then cool. Finish Line might, you know, fit the journey. But some of that stuff I just was never into. And I just wanted to be inside my book. I read a lot, wanted to be inside books and then be inside my rhyme book. So I just followed that.
So you had your goals and your kind of aspirations, but storytelling was kind of the vehicle to get it done, sort of.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah. So how did you end up in LA? How did you make the trip from Temple out that way?
Oh man, windy road. I actually was in LA before I went to Temple. I had a scholar. I got a bunch of scholarships, and I went to USC for a year. I was in their film school, and yeah, man, they hijacked all my scholarship money, and the guy that recruited me to the school left the school my first year, so I had to transfer, and that's how I got out to Temple. And at Temple. I was a double major in film and theater. And then I just let the face decide. I auditioned for all the drama program, all the top drama schools. I auditioned for all the top film schools. And the film schools cost a lot of money. It's a lot of hidden costs in there because you got to pay for tuition. But then you also, at least at, when I was going, you also had to pay for your films as well. And I ain't had no money like that. And I got into all the top drama schools. And so that's how I came back
out
here.
USC's not a cheap school to begin with. Yeah.
I had a lot of student loans before, after the first year. So I was already, you know, cooking in that regard. So after I left Temple, I went to drama school at UC San Diego with the La Jolla Playhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. I was there for 3 years. And then after that, there's a showcase that happens. I call it like the NFL draft for actors. Yale, UCSD, and NYU at the time did a showcase together. And so for me, I was betting. I said, look, man, I don't care which of the three schools I go to. All I got to do is get in that room at the end and I'm going to shine. And so I got in that room, got an agent. And then that summer, I booked a role on this show called Harry's Law and moved up to L.A.
What did you think about being in San Diego? I used to live in Encinitas, which I guess is a little north of Hoya there, but that's a beautiful part of the country.
Beautiful.
Right there.
Very, very, very beautiful. Very underrated. A lot of people know about, obviously, L.A., but I mean, San Diego is beautiful. La Jolla is absolutely gorgeous, man. So it was a great incubation period to be able to work on theater and hone your craft.
So Harry's Law, that was with she was Misery. Why am I drawing blank?
Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates. Well, that's kind of cool to get on that.
Yeah.
And I saw you did Justify.
Rectify.
You know, I always conflate the two of those. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was friends with JD, you know, JD Evermore.
Yes. Very talented brother.
You know, I proudly lost out to a couple gigs for him back when we were in New Orleans, you know. Mm-hmm. But last time I saw him, he was at my birthday, a little birthday shindig, and just the nicest, most down to earth guy. And I was so happy when he got that because I was like, okay, he needs to land something good, you know. So, you know, but it's funny enough, that's still on my list of, you know, there's so much stuff out there. Yeah. And there's so many shows and movies. I'm like, okay, I still haven't watched Game of Thrones. I'm still one of those guys. You know, so I'm still catching up. That's one of the shows on the list. I'm now just getting into Homeland. I'm only like 15 years behind. I'm catching up.
I always say you get to it when you get to it, man. You get to it when you get to it. There's so much going on in everybody's life and all that. And so I always say you get to it when you get to it. And that's the best thing about art. You know, it finds you at the right time. And sometimes you can't rush it. I mean, that happened to me with Succession. I didn't get into Succession until maybe season two. And I had a great friend of mine from the festival circuit was like, bro, you need to watch this. And I was like, look, man, I ain't trying to watch that, man. It looked boring. I'm good. And he said, just give it four episodes. And I gave it the four and I was like, yo, this is nuts. So, you know, you gotta find it when it's the right time.
But when you were growing up, what was kind of artistically grabbing you musically and, you know, film, what were the things that kept you captivated and kind of, 'cause I know you're into writing, but you know, like any kind of artist, other things besides your specific genre can kind of, you know, get your juices flowing.
Absolutely. Hip hop. I wouldn't be where I'm at without hip hop. Mos Def, Talib Kweli, Shoot Common, like they were very instrumental in my development as an artist based off, you know, the subject matter of their work, how deep it goes, the things about, you know, capitalism and the other isms that they were willing to tackle in their music was very instrumental for me as an artist. And then also too, like I was just into I'm thinking about A Lesson Before Dying. I'm trying to think of books that really hit me when I was younger. The Animorph series. I love science fiction. There's a book about all these like personified rats called Redwall that I would read. Yeah, man, Toni Morrison. There's so much James Baldwin. There's so much that I read when I was younger that, you know, like really grabbed me. Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. So, yeah.
Well, you're kind of the OG. When you look at hip hop and, you know, I'm not saying it was my, like the very first radio station I worked for, this is back in 1990. Mm. And it was kind of a mix of top 40 and it was, they called it Churban, C-H-R-Urban. Right, you know, it was right, kind right. of, and it, speaking of John, like Johnny Gill, Keith Sweat, all that. You know, and then they'd also play like New Kids on the Block. It was it was the weirdest mishmash, but but that's coming off the back end of, you know, when hip hop was really getting going. But like now it's, I don't know, like for someone like you who the written word, the spoken word, it's important. How has hip hop in your mind changed from when, what was inspiring you to now? Is it a progression or different thing totally?
I think Duke Ellington had this quote, when art and commerce collide, art ultimately suffers. So I think it's gone the way that many things go in this American wilderness when you start infusing capitalism and materialism and corporate interests and all that stuff. You know, when hip-hop was first starting out in the 80s and in the 90s, it was people telling stories about parts of the world, parts of the country that were overlooked. And so as Mos Def just talked about in the battle with Drake, he said, you know, this is music. Now it's a lot of this music is music you listen to when you're shopping at Target.
I was at the grocery store the other day and they were playing, I mean, regular big grocery store, and Ozzy Osbourne was on. I was like, dude, we're in different times now. Like this would never, you know, but yeah, you're right. 'Cause you know, here I, you know, the way I grew up, it wasn't my main thing, but it was in the ether. It was there. It was part of what was going on, you know, late 80s, early 90s. You know, there was, you know, everybody kind of knew something, you know. But now it seems, like you said, it seems like rap acts are disposable. Like it seems like they have a season and then they're on to the next thing. Yeah. Whereas, you know, the names that, like you're mentioning, are still talked about, and a lot of those guys are still putting out work, you know. Yeah. And it really, in your mind, does it really rest on the story that's being told? Is it, you know, it's like whenever I talk to musicians, I'm like, is it the music or is it the lyric that get you started on a song? It seems to me that hip hop really kind of started with the story. And you know what I mean? It seems like, I mean, I'm a lay person here.
I think there's a musical story and there's a written story. You know, hip hop started with the DJ. And I think that's a musical story, a sonic story. You know, the MC didn't come until a little later because you had the Breakers. You had the graffiti artists. You know, when we talk about hip hop's history, you know, getting it started in New York. But I think you can come to art in any way but art kind of requires you to have something to say, especially if you want to have longevity. I see a kindred spirit between, you know, Tom Hanks's career and Mos Def's career. You know, you can be an influencer and get hot on Instagram or TikTok for a season in the same way you could be a rapper or a pop artist that has a couple songs for a summer. But that doesn't mean you're going to have longevity or respect as an artist. And for me, respect as an artist and contributing to the betterment of the country, the betterment of, you know, human civilization is I think what most artists are trying to do, whether you're Meryl Streep or Mos Def.
Because they have chapters to their story. Like you said, Tom Hanks, he's had different chapters, and a lot of them are just where he's at in the moment, but also where age he is and, you know, what stories there are to tell at that age, you know. With the written word, with the spoken word and all that, and then when you look at screenplays, has there been kind of like a confluence? You know, have you ever thought about writing a screenplay? Have you written screenplays?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know? Only thing I wish about the screenplay format, I wish some of these screenplays were published like novels. And sometimes it's a pity, you know, especially being out here in this Hollywood wilderness, like you read a lot of great scripts, and because they haven't been produced, they have no life. And right, I think that's one of the worst things about the screenplay format. Like, I've read people's scripts and they'll be like, oh, well, you know, if so-and-so don't buy it, now it's just underneath the bed. And I'm like, F that. Shoot. Like, make the action part of it more prosy and, like, publish it. Like, there's so much. Maybe you can start a new genre. I don't know. So for me, the written word is just is I mean, there's a reason why, you know, storytelling has affected all of us across culture, all over the world for centuries and centuries. You know, so I love all formats. I just try to approach it, like I said, with something to say.
What's really sad is when you hear about this, and I've talked to many folks who've written a story, written a screenplay. It's been optioned and purchased. And it just gets dropped at some bottom of some stack at a studio, and it just kind of dies there. I'm like, or they actually have made the project, they've shot it, and for whatever reason, just never gets released. But like what you're saying is a way to kind of, you know, in that scenario is, you know, bring it back to life. Is, I don't know if it's Quentin Tarantino or there are different people. You look at their screenwriting style, and that in itself is cool to look at. You know, it's very visual and specific, and the theater of your mind kind of kicks in. You know, So do you have, like, if you were to set out and you're like produce it, write and produce and put out a show or a movie of your own, like what would be a story that you want to put out there that has been kind of humming around in your mind for a while?
Oh, shoot. Got one right now. It's called Laying Pipe. It's about two oil tycoons that meet at a strip club, and they are discussing the a deal that could unseat the oil industry as a whole. It's an oil tycoon from Oklahoma and an oil tycoon from Nigeria, based off two real life billionaires. And at the end of the story, they're given 77 weeks to unlay the pipe that has been destroying the planet. So for me, the stories that I gravitate to, that I like to write about, are things that are affecting, you know, real people. I like to write about what the truth is. And I don't mean that in like an altruistic way. When you watch a lot of TV shows, like, you know, I'll talk about, you know, gun violence, for example. People have a very Hollywood understanding of what it's like to be in war, because they've seen Rambo, they've seen all these kinds of things. And then when you watch something like Saving Private Ryan, you understand that war might not be something you want to do.
It takes all the romance out of it.
Like that sliding across the car hood with the gun and you do a backflip. Rambo gonna get shot 55 times and be dead on minute two of the conflict. So for me, it's about talking about those, real issues, man. Especially as they affect, black and brown and impoverished communities, from America and abroad. So those are the stories that I'm interested in, because all too often those are the stories, you know, we're not allowed to, to be a part of. So, you know, for me, that's what I'm focused on. That's what I was focused on as a poet. That's what I'm focused on as an actor, as I create character. And that's what I'm focused on as a writer when it comes to screenplays or any of the books that I'm thinking about putting together. I actually, Laying Pipe, I'm very proud of it. It actually just won the Climate Pitch Award at the Michaux Film Festival earlier this year. So we got some really interesting things in the works for that project.
Hey, I'm Andy from the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
The Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
Our show is pretty simple. Five lifelong friends competing on a single topic to see who gets bragging rights. Each episode, Nick, Scott, Brian, Kelly, and I battle through 10 questions on movies, music, science, history, sports, whatever we decide to throw in the blender for that week. Every episode stands on its own, so you can jump in wherever your curiosity takes you. And we don't just stop at right or wrong. We get into the backstory, the origins, the weird facts, and the stuff that has you saying, "How did I not know that already?" So download an episode, play along, keep score, and tell us how you do. See if you can beat the crew on the Ultimate Trivia Podcast.
It's funny you said that about the truth of war, what things really like. I forgot the name. It's not warfare. It came out. It's about a platoon of young guys, and it came out within the last year, I think. And it gets kind of gruesome. You know, it shows you what, you know, and I can't think of the name of it. And actually, it's so good that I can only get through about half of it. It's like, I got to come back to this tomorrow. Right. Because it was intense. And it was like, I don't know, maybe before anybody kind of okays or funds a war, they need to watch that, you know, watch that movie. Like,
12 Years a Slave is like that. 12 Years a Slave is like that. It's an accurate depiction of what the 19th century was like in this country. And so it's hard for a lot of people to watch, as it should be hard for a lot of people to watch, about the institution of slavery and the things that were going on. So if I'm approaching a story about anything, whether it's World War I, World War II, what it's like to be a police officer or being policed in a community, even a romantic comedy about relationships and things like that, I think you have an obligation to the truth. And Hollywood is not doesn't have a great track record when it comes to that. But also, I think that's what actually makes stories timeless. That's what makes stories resonate with people. You know, you think about, you know, a project that really hit me, I always reference it as Parasite. Director Bong is one of my favorite directors. And that's not a movie you make in an algorithm or in a studio, or, you know, it's a movie that's made by somebody with something to say about capitalism and poverty, and the healthcare, the healthcare industry and all that, you know? So, you know, those are my artistic, spirit animals. Artists.
You know, I'm kind of hoping, and I was talking to somebody the other day about this, that my kids' generation, Gen Z, they're in their early 20s, that they're going to bring another, you know, independent film renaissance, you know, because we had one like a little while back. Because you know, and I've talked to many people, and anybody who listens to this show, you know, I've said this, but it's like the whole comedy thing. You don't have all the comedies coming out that you used to have because of economics, because it doesn't play as well overseas or whatever. But that's where you ever just land on an independent film, like you're just trying to find something. And like, I spend more time just cruising around the different streamers, like trying to find something to watch, you know, and I accidentally land on something that's like independent. It's interesting. It's just off of what you're kind of used to. And like, you know, like, I don't know how that got made. Maybe it's somebody. They always say for actors, do one for the studio, do one for you, you know, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
This is the one for you, for some actor. I'm like, and it's like, yeah, that's what I really enjoy, is finding those gems that tell a story that resonates, that feels true, even though maybe you haven't experienced it. It's like, you get a window into somebody else's life. And I think that's kind of what hip hop was all about. You know, you can get some, you know, white guy from the suburbs can listen to it, go, oh, I kind of get this now. Absolutely. And I see parallels and, you know. And I think that breeds more empathy, but I'm not going to go down that philosophical road. You know.
It's not even philosophical, good brother. That's what it is. That's what art is supposed to do. That's what art does. You know, you can read a book about, you know, what's going on in North Korea. You can read a book, Toni Morrison, and understand what it's like to be in a woman's shoes, et cetera. That's what art is supposed to do. It's supposed to, you know, open a window to a different, you know, area. And it creates common ground, because you realize, you know, you living in poverty in West Virginia, you know what I'm saying? Some of them coal mines. And then you realize, oh, I have a kindred spirit to, you know, folks that are living in Mississippi that may be black or brown or what have you. So that's what art is supposed to do. That's what, you know, and you know, just to piggyback off what you were saying, so much of the big things that went boom in our culture over the last years, I think about Squid Games, I think about Get Out. These were all movies that had something to say about, the issues of our time. And they came out of the blue because they just came from an artist that was trying to say something. You know what I mean? And I think normally, you know, those are the given circumstances for producing great art. Very, very rarely does it happen when you, I don't know, I don't want to diss nobody, but you know, a candy bar commercial or a cereal commercial is producing your movie, your joint might be whack. Just like if you do a hip hop record for, said tissue, I don't know, Ted Tissue brand. I mean, it might be whack, man. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah, that's kind of that balance I think art has always struck, even going back to like the Renaissance and the you know, who's financing it, you know?
Right, right.
And some of the financiers, like, here's your money, go create art. And other ones are like, well, you know, we got to sell candy bars, you know?
Yeah.
So I was curious, like, how did Cross come your way? How did that, was that something that was like floating around for a bit and then, you know, just kind of landed it? But how did that come together for you specifically?
Beautiful. It's a beautiful serendipity, man. Big shout out to my showrunner, Ben Watkins, for seeing something and pushing for it, man. I was offered my role on Cross, which is a beautiful blessing to be offered something, not to have to audition, especially when this type of character, it's not like it's on my reel where I just, you know, I play giraffes and they need a giraffe, so they went to the giraffe dude. I actually auditioned for Ben for a show called Hand of God. At this point, it might be like 8 or 9 years ago.
Hand of God. Yeah. What was that?
It was a show on Amazon. I forget the given circumstances from it because it was one of those auditions I had to put out of my mind. It was like a totem for me in my career. I remember the first audition. It was at Kerry Barton's office in Santa Monica. Went in and I played like this storefront preacher. And so, you know, I'm not the biggest church cat. So I did my homework, got this thing down to the socks. And I remember there was a word in the monologue I had to do, a word called chrysalis, that I just didn't think that, you know, the character would use this word. And so when I was preaching, you know, I used everybody kind of as the, you know, as the congregation. And I remember saying, I improvised a line. I looked right at Ben when I said, this word ain't make no sense. Let me break it down for you. And he gave me this look. And after I did a call to worship, the whole nine, I got a standing ovation in the audition, man. Everybody started clapping the whole nine. And really? So when I left, there was like a pug in that office. And when I opened the door to leave, the pug was looking up like, what the fuck was happening in there, man? Like, it was great. What was going on in there? And so I remember I walked to my car because I used to always park, you know, 10 blocks away so I could walk, you know, get, you know, and
get
I was
your head
crying.
Centered.
Yeah. 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 And I was crying on my way leaving because I said, there's no way I'm not getting this part. There's no way. And guess what? I ain't get it. Guess what? I ain't get it.
Isn't that crazy the way that works? I know some things that I've come across in life. It's like some things like, I blew this thing. There ain't no way. And I get a call like, you got it. I'm like, what?
Dude, it was crazy. Okay. I didn't get it. And then they called me back for another role on there. Didn't get that. And so, for the next 7-8 years, I just lived my life and was like, damn, I didn't get that part. Maybe I did this. Maybe I did that. You kind of go in the actor brain. Fast forward to, I'm at Austin Film Festival, the film I directed. I get a message from a friend. They're asking me, hey, you got anything going on in these dates this time? And I'm like, yeah, I might go do a play. What's going on? He said, well, we'll get back to you. And that's when a few months later, they reached out and offered me Cross. And it was because Ben had seen me 7 years ago or 8 years ago and was like, how is this brother not working? He did two completely different characters in the span of a week. And I guess he just had me in mind that entire time. So it's just one of those things about always, you know, kind of being persistent and and, you know, kind of running your own race, and then things find you when they find you. And the beautiful thing to me about that story is, if you hear Ben tell it, it's the first time I've had an experience that's the exact same experience told from two different perspectives. You feel me? So when he told me. I, you know, there's all these things, these insecurities as an actor you have, or as a performer, where you try to say, I didn't get it right, but they had already had an offer. They had offers out already. So it was one of those things to where they was like, oh shoot, this guy was so good, they're making me reconsider. But to be able to do good business, it's like, yo, we can't, boom, boom, boom. And so like, there's all these other things you're like, dang, I had no idea that was even, you know, going on. So I always tell
actors. Isn't that just a thing? It's like, yeah, when you look at like what it takes to get a movie from script to get it actually out there in the world. And then you realize statistically for an actor to get on a project, you know, you start realizing there are all these moving parts that you got no control over.
No control. But yeah,
it sounds like to me that resonated in your mind, like same thing for him. It stayed in his mind. It's not like, and there was something that there was a fire that was lit for both y'all, I guess, you know. So that's cool. It, you know, when somebody can remember you and you kind of, you know, you kind of live rent free, you know, as they say, you know, in some way.
Also, too, you just never know when that blessing is going to get paid forward, man. I put it like this. I don't believe in quitting, and I firmly believe in quitting. Some things you need to, like, I think self-awareness is very much lacking in our culture, right? There's people trying to be singers who can't sing. Like, you can't sing at all, man. You're supposed to be a chef, or you're supposed to start that janitorial firm, or you're supposed to be a mathematician, etc. So I don't think you should quit at something that you are blessed with a talent, and it's something that you're genuinely, a vocation you're genuinely pursuing. And that's what acting is for me. And sometimes people will quit their vocation because of the world, or because of they're not making the money they want to make, etc. And I tell a lot of you, you might just have to be broke, man. Like, that's might be what you have to do if you want to pursue the thing that you genuinely love. And there's a difference between,
Believe that 100%. It's like that thing I always hear, and I've talked to all the people, dozens and dozens or hundreds, I guess, I've talked to at this point, that they say, like, if you can imagine yourself doing something else, then maybe acting and this thing isn't for you. But if you're just like, this is the only thing, there is a fire that's, you know, just smoldering, it's got to happen. Then, yeah, like you say, maybe you can be broke for a moment, and it probably will make no sense to everybody around you. They're going to think, oh, you're being foolish. But I've also, like you said, the whole watching American Idol thing and like going, you know what? You almost get to the point of going, are they taking advantage of people by, you know, it's like,
I mean,
you know, it's like, listen, it's like, yeah, you know, there's something else out there that probably, I always wondered, like, I never played an instrument. I'm like wondering, was I ever a virtuoso? Would I ever been like, you know, really good at playing trumpet or something? Right, you know, it's like that. Was there a talent out there that the thing I never explored? And that's kind of a thing where it's kind of fun to still do your thing, but sample some other stuff, like in acting, you can direct, you can write, you can try other things and see, is there something out there that really fires you up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, was there anything else that, you know, like that you're still, I'm not saying working on, but you've through your discovery, through all the work you've done, are you like, okay, this is something I need to try. This is something that it's got to get on the buffet of life. You know, I gotta sample this also.
Something in the animal science space, man. I love animals. I love nature. I got a, you know, garden here in Los Angeles. Something in that space. I don't know how it's gonna, you know, come out. You know, whether that has to deal with climate change or what have you. But I'm a big animals nerd, always have been, love dinosaurs.
Where did that start for you? You know, because you talked about that. Talked about the environmental thing, the animal thing.
Maybe Portland. You know. Portland is a very big environmental place. You know, a lot of these ideals I didn't realize were implanted in me because I grew up in Portland until I left. You know, people were composting when I was growing up. There's parks and stuff everywhere. There's greenery everywhere. People are hiking. And, you know, you can kind of soak up those things through osmosis. You know, when there's a woodpecker, you know, banging, you know, on a fern outside your house or evergreen. So I think it was just, you know, the curiosity of a young person that was, you know, thanks to my mom, cultivated through all the programs and stuff she put me in, whether that was MESA, which was Math, Engineering, Science, Achievement. I was in Upward Bound. I was in the Prospective Gents Club, the Rites of Passage program. She had me cooking, playing sports. I was doing everything. And, you know, I wish our education system didn't just, you know, breed people to be a part of manufacturing or to, you know, work in an office. Mm-hmm. So people got the opportunity to explore their heart's desires so that then, you know, I don't know, that young brother in Alabama is the dude that's going to cure cancer because he was cultivated to find that inside of himself. I think the hardest thing about our gifts is that, you know, I think acting, sports, those things are gifts in many times you can see on the outside. Right. You mm-hmm. can see a poet where it's much harder to identify a virtuoso that's a mathematician or someone that could be a surgeon or someone that might, you know, create the next vaccine, because those things are inside of the mind, inside of, you know, the heart, and can't. And, you know, LeBron James is 6'8" and runs fast. He runs. And you're like, yeah, I think this dude might have a future, you know. And I would love to, you know, hopefully we, you know, create those same dynamics so we can identify the next, you know, scientist or astrophysicist or marine biologist as well.
You know, it's I heard it's that idea that, you know, when you talk, we were talking like war, you're talking about like all the social ills, and does that extinguish or not give a pathway to someone who could have cured cancer or to something mm-hmm. like that. When you hear those stories, I think that's when that feels good for you. When you hear those stories of somebody, the odds are stacked against them, but they then created this thing that they just, whatever was happening internally, nobody saw that actually took them somewhere. You know,
yeah.
you love hearing those stories, but you study societies. That's not like you're talking about the economics before, but talk about hip hop. Right.
Yeah.
That's not always something that is, you know, hardwired, you know, in our society to make, you know, for that to actually happen. So it's good when
Absolutely.
It does, you know.
Yeah.
So now do you have any kids? Do you have any little folks running around or?
Nah, no kids, but I got a lot of nieces. My sisters was getting busy.
Oh.
A lot of nieces and nephews.
Well, and you're an animal guy. I got to ask what if you got any pets?
Nah, no pets. I travel too much. So I got my stuffed animals. Yeah. I got them.
All right.
And I got my plant babies, you know, cause they can survive, you know, while I'm, you know, on the road. But you know, I hopefully those things come, you know, a little further down the line.
Yeah. I'm the same way, man. I've always been like, I think my grandmother always was, she always had plants, and I always do, you know, I got like tropical stuff cause that's supposed to be good. Like people having tropical plants in the house supposed to be good.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
cleans the air. You heard
yeah,
that, you
yeah.
know? So, yeah, so that's kind of been like a thing. But I got a 2-year-old golden retriever who's upstairs
okay,
who's dying to
okay.
come down here. So, you know, I'm a big animal. You know, it's funny. I was in an art gallery the other day, and the artist was telling me, because I live down here on South Padre Island in Texas, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of a little wired into the art community down here. And I was at an artist gallery, and there's this big open space. It was really cool. And she said, you know, it's like kind of a warehouse thing near the mm-hmm. Ship channel. And she was telling me when she went in there, and it looks beautiful now, but she said it was a dump. She said, again, raccoons who were like falling through the ceiling. My initial thing was like, oh man, poor raccoons, man. I hope they're okay.
Right.
You know, I'm sitting there, other people would be like freaked out by it, but I'm thinking like the raccoons are, you know, I think raccoons are kind of cool.
No, I think they're great. I always say there's enough room for us. There's enough room for us all. I think we're going through a renaissance right now as human beings, and especially in the Western world, are trying to understand how we can sustain what we have. We can't sustain polluting the oceans and killing all the raccoons and mm-hmm. and building freeways through migration patterns. I mean, we're seeing it even out here with the fires, even in Australia, where people are starting to re-engage the indigenous communities because they have been dealing with those things for centuries, and we're told,
well, they cracked, you know, the code.
So, yeah,
they cracked the code and they understood it. They understood
exactly.
it at a level of like it's symbiosis. That's nice. The one thing that yeah. I gather that those cultures understood, you know, you only take what you need. And you hear about
yeah.
like when, you know, Native Americans, they would kill a buffalo. Every single part of that buffalo, it was a symbiotic relationship. Is not
right.
That's the reason why, you know, God love them. I'm not, you know, if somebody loves hunting, good for them. But I never the killing for the sake of killing never understood. But you hear you see the indigenous people's relationship
right.
to the land. It was a symbiosis. So it's interesting to kind of, you know, but you got to keep that kind of keeps you grounded, like aspirationally. You want to kind of at least
Absolutely.
Work in that direction. So is it like where do you think it like with your aspirations of? Mm-hmm. You know, your connections to, I will just say in general, nature and stuff. Where's the ultimate destination you'd like to live? You know, like, where do you think, like, back in Portland, or is there somewhere in the world you're like, this is
I don't know, man. I don't know. I've loved some places. Obviously, Portland has a very special place in my heart because I was raised there. My family's there. But I always feel at home. You know, when I'm back in Africa, I was in South Africa. I was in Ghana, beautiful places. I've been in South America. Feels great there. I was in Peru, in Colombia. I was studying Spanish there. Even Hong Kong. I loved Hong Kong. Toronto's a good city. So if I move somewhere, it'll probably be somewhere international. It makes me understand, you know, my forefathers so much. You know, during the Harlem Renaissance, during the Civil Rights Movement, people like James Baldwin, they left and went to France. They left and went to some of these other places. And when I was in school, you know, I understood it more as more of an academic, in an academic sense. But there does seem to be some weight that is off of you, you know, when you leave for a little bit. And I think it re-energized a lot of those brothers and sisters to be able to come back and be a part of the movements that they were a part of. So, yeah, probably somewhere international, man. But I have to get back to you on that one.
I don't necessarily have wanderlust, but, you know, I kind of like, you know, wandering around and kind of checking out new things always been very intriguing for me. But real quick, going back to Cross and being a writer, have you ever tried to plug in and say, hey, can I get into the writer's room on any of the episodes?
Nah. I mean, they let me, you know, they let me improv or change the line here, you know, here or there to try to make it more specific to the character. You know, and so I appreciate that collaboration, but I let the writers write, man. You know, I stay focused on the metaphor of my character, the all the different, you know, layers that I'm trying to bring, you know, across all the different, you know, vantage points for, you know, Bobby Trey. So I let them do the writing thing. And then, like I said, we just collaborate on the day. We'll have conversations about certain lines, but, you know, I let them do that. And you'll probably see me writing on something else.
As far as Bobby Trey, the character, was there anybody in your life that you looked at that's kind of like a totem that like, okay, this is who I'm channeling a little bit? Or was it kind of like, you know,
it was all a metaphor. First time I created a character strictly from a metaphor. Me and Ben had a conversation before season one about, you know, his motivations he was giving me. You know, obviously we had a conversation. And I wanted to know why in season one he was working with this, you know, serial killer. And he said that Bobby Trey was addicted to money. I asked him why. And he said because his family's land was stolen from him in Louisiana. And if, you know, it should be, you know, common knowledge, but many black and brown people had their communities stolen from them via eminent domain. Freeways were built through people's communities. Oh,
yeah. What do they call it? They call it redlining and stuff.
Redlining is a part of that. It happened in Portland, actually. I-5, there was a big black community in Northeast Portland, and I-5 was built through it and it displaced all those people. So with that historical context, the first thing I wrote in my notes as an actor, I said, Bobby Trey is a metaphor for capitalism because of that addiction. I said, you know, capitalism is incredibly charming. We invite it into our homes every day, but it's also incredibly vicious. It'll pollute the shoreline, tear down the entire rainforest, and then sell it to you for, you know, $200 million or whatever. So that was the engine that started Bobby Trey. And then after that, you know, we talked about where it was from. Shreveport came up. And so Shreveport's up there in that corridor where it's influenced by so many different places in the state.
Well, see, I live 20 years in New Orleans, but I'm from Dallas originally. Yeah. So I know that Shreveport's a real interesting, it's kind of like people in Louisiana consider it Texas, you know, because it's so far, you know, up there. But it's because it doesn't have a lot of the same, you know, Cajun Creole kind of root. But it's got it's got that same, I don't want to say corruption. But it, you know, Louisiana's got a history with, I remember my aunt told me something before I moved down to New Orleans to take a job down there back in 98. She said, a friend of hers from New Orleans said that they don't expect their politicians to be corrupt. They demand it. You know,
I got to steal that one.
But there's stories down there and some of them are just heartbreaking because, you know, a lot of the black folks down there who get into politics campaign in their communities, but they have no, once they're in office, they're not doing anything for the people who got them in office. So to watch that go, that there's a big disconnect because everything that is New Orleans, the food, the music, you know, even, you know, if you look at, Louis Armstrong, Park, I forgot the name of it. I cannot remember the name, but it's where a lot of the slaves go and play music. They, if you, you can draw a direct line from that to rock and roll, you know, right. Where it started. I just like, you know, I did my tour of duty in New Orleans for 20 years.
And it's a beautiful city. I shot a show down there called Underground. We were in New Orleans and we were also in Baton Rouge for a little bit. And so, you know, I learned a lot about Shreveport. Actually, when you talk about being in the writer's room, I want to shout out season one. There's a scene, I think it's episode 3, where I'm at the wharf in Bobby Trey's at the wharf in D.C. And there's this whole scene about Shreveport stuffed shrimp, which is a delicacy that goes back to, I believe, 1914, maybe 1921, really? If I'm not mistaken. Absolutely. And so this goes to show how collaboration winds up making great art. So the scene was written originally, I think I was supposed to be eating like Cajun fish or something like that. But in my research on Shreveport and on what could have been potentially Bobby Trey's origins, I came across this delicacy Shreveport stuffed shrimp. Excuse me. And so I reached out to the writing team and said, hey, can Bobby Trey be eating this or see notice this? And to their credit, 2 days later, the entire scene was changed and it was about Shreveport stuffed shrimp. Really? And so, yeah. And so that's how, again, I'm not in the writer's room, but that's my contribution, because cultural authenticity is incredibly important to me. You know, Black people are not a monolith around the country. All too often we all sound like we from New York or something in every show that transpires. And so to pay it all the way forward, the beautiful thing is when the show came out, you would see comments. I'll never forget, there was a comment on Facebook, which, first of all, I didn't know people were still on Facebook, but apparently it does a lot of numbers. It does a lot of numbers. I didn't know, but I'll never get this. That scene went viral in Louisiana. And there was a woman, she chronicled this on Facebook. She was like, I was cutting, you know, you have a show on in the background, and she was chopping vegetables. You know, she was listening across and blah, blah, blah. And then when she heard Shreveport stuffed shrimp, she said, I almost cut my finger off, because I couldn't believe that was being represented. You feel me? So to me, that's the full circle of that moment, about how if you're in true collaboration, trying to tell the truth, trying to be authentic, and then you see how it pays forward and it touches people. You know what I mean? So,
like, that's one of the things I think tells the story of a culture. It's your music, it's your dance, it's the food. And that's why I love, I love talking food, because I'm just like, I like to eat, you know.
Yeah, me too.
Well, that actually brings me to something I do every towards the back end when I have a chat, is something I call my 7 questions. And okay. I always end up talking food.
Okay. Let's do it.
First question I always ask is, what is your favorite comfort food? That thing it just lands for you. If you've had a great day, you've had a kind of a crummy day, it just warms the soul or just makes you feel
sick. Man,
you
know? I'm gonna give like a multi shoot. My mom's collard greens always, and then ramen, bro. Ramen. I love me some ramen. Let me a little ramen spot. You get the juice all in your beard. Yeah, it's
that's one thing. Being down here on the island, we don't have a good ramen, or a pho, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, pho, yeah.
You just kind of load it up, just like dump it all in there. You know, it's like one big bowl, and you just kind of work on that bowl for a while, and
it'll put you right to bed.
Absolutely. God, I can't do this before I have lunch, man, because I'm just getting hungry. For folks listening to the show, it seems like I always record right around now, and I'm like, I haven't had anything to eat yet. I'm like, oh God, that sounds good. Well, I'm about an hour away from, I don't know, we're down here on the South Texas coast, where SpaceX launches their rockets is 5 miles from here.
Okay.
So, but we got Brownsville, which is, you know, it's right on the border, you know, but I got to drive at least 45 minutes to get to anywhere that's sort of like, you know.
Sort of. Cool. Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you got to take that drive, man.
Now you got me. It's Friday. I've got a ramen thing happening. I'm going to blame it on you. While I'm doing that drive, I'm like, I want ramen. So now the next question, if you're going to sit down with 3 people, living or not, and you're talking story for hours over coffee, it's you and 3 people. Who would those 3 people be that you think would make for a great afternoon or evening of coffee?
Damn. I want to sit with August Wilson, Sidney Poitier, and Toni Morrison.
Who's the first one again?
August Wilson.
Oh, okay, okay. August Wilson. Sidney Poitier. Like that guy, you know, if eloquence was embodied in a human being, that was Sidney Poitier. You know, The next question is to go back when you were young, got to know, who was your very first celebrity crush?
Oh, man, dang. You're going to get me in trouble here, man. this is crazy. Probably Topanga from Boy Meets World.
You know what? You're the second or third person who said that, you know? Yeah, so God, who was it? I could actually dig it up in the records and find out who
bad,
it was.
Man. She was bad, man. This is going to sound crazy too, because this is an animated character. So you probably guess it. But if you ever seen the Goofy movie, Roxanne on the Goofy movie, we would be like growing up, I'd be like, man, this is a bad cartoon character, brother. So yeah. Yeah.
Who was it when I was young? There was a cartoon character. Oh, Jessica Rabbit. You know, everybody.
Yes.
You know,
yes. Yes.
Now, if let's say you're going to be living on an exotic island for a year, somewhere you want to be, somewhere nice, but it doesn't have streaming. So if you want to listen to music, you got to bring one CD, or I'll say a box set. And you, to watch a movie over and over again, it's got to be just one DVD. What would that one CD and one DVD be you could check out all year long on that island?
The Ecstatic by Mos Def. Yes, The Ecstatic. And movie? Dang, that's tough. One movie, I'm going to have to go. It would either be Liar Liar or Life, probably.
Liar, Liar,
well, Jim Carrey.
With Jim Carrey. With Jim Carrey.
Or Life with Martin and Eddie.
Oh, God, that was good. That was, in fact, wasn't that supposed to be at like a Louisiana prison, if I'm not mistaken?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure where they was. I know they was on the chain gang, but that movie's funny, man.
But you mentioned Jim Carrey. I got a quick sidebar on In Living Color. What were your thoughts ever in Living Color?
It was ahead of its time in many ways. Ahead of its time, you know, before we had Chappelle's Show, before we had those things, you had comedy. I think
the Wayans family, there was something in the water their mother was drinking when she had,
some kind of kale or something, some kale juice they was drinking. I don't know. But yeah, man, ahead of their time, man. Titans.
I think they need to bring that show back for our era we're living in now. I think there's commentary that can be made. George Carlin. If we can bring them back, I think right now.
Oh, George Carlin, underrated, man. George Carlin was talking that good talk, man. George Carlin, man, for sure.
If anybody goes back to, I'm talking early 90s, one of his comedy shows, you played it right now, it'd be like it's fresh and current to like he had like some kind of crystal ball, you know. He knew something was coming, you know. Now, if you're to say from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed, your definition of a perfect day, what are the component parts? What's part of that recipe for that perfect day for you?
Not giving into your lower self, the bad, you know, the things, my therapist would call it your lower nature. Your lower nature says negative things to you in your head. It makes you procrastinate. It makes you scroll on Instagram, that. So I kind of distill my day down into just one foot in front of the other, man. Like, that the moment to moment perseverance, the moment to moment. Okay, I'm a Spanish homework. Okay, I need to send this email. Okay, I need to do this thing, and then those moments stack. So for me, it's just about staying in the moment and putting one foot in front of the other. So you know, everything doesn't become too large, and you can just keep the main thing the main thing.
So are you studying Spanish right now?
Yeah.
I, you know, living down here, I'm. I think that everybody down here, I'd say like 90% of the people on the island, Spanish or Mexican background.
Claro que sí, mi hermano.
Well, you know what I do. I sit there and I try to speak it. And I know they give me this Mexican look of bless your heart. You know, they know I'm trying. You know, but it's like there's certain things I'm learning. There's certain phrases, and that's different from Southern California to down here in South Texas. Even the Mexican food is a little bit different, you know. Because you remember San Diego, they got mole sauces and stuff like you don't find that as. But again, I'm talking food. I got to be careful because I'm hungry. But that's cool. You're doing that because my kids went to Spanish immersion. You know, they
that's
can speak
beautiful. It. That's amazing, man.
My, And I think that's so good. We're one of the few countries where speaking, my best friend's from Holland, and you know, everybody there speaks two or three languages, like, as a matter of course. I think that, going back to empathy. I think no one has to speak a different language, maybe cooking a different kind of culture's food. I think it kind of helps you understand people, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole.
You absolutely should go down that rabbit hole. I think living in America is, I always say, learning is unlearning. We were told a lot of things about the rest of the world. You know, when I was in South Africa, I was meeting people just regular that speak nine languages.
Isn't that crazy?
It's so important. So for me, Spanish was important to start learning, because when we were in school, it wasn't pressed upon us as something that was important. It was this idea that English was the only tongue that mattered. And so I want to be a world citizen. So being able to speak another language, go into somebody else's home and being able to take your shoes off and do it the way they, you know, participate the way they participate is one thing. I also didn't want my niece to be the only person in our family that spoke Spanish. I wanted her to be able to have someone to practice with and be able to, you know, have conversations with if she wants to. So,
you're inspiring me here. Yeah, my spirit animal, rest his soul, is Anthony Bourdain. You know, his life is kind of where I wanted to be, just kind of be a citizen of the world and check it out. No judgment, just, you know.
Positivamente, mi hermano, necesitas aprender español, especialmente. Eres en una ciudad importante. La ciudad tiene mucha gente. Hablan español, so it's important for you, my guy.
Yeah, very. It's perfecto, mi amigo.
Here we go.
Now, if you weren't doing this, last couple questions, if this was not available to you, the creative thing, to be able to express yourself like this, what would be your number two as a vocation?
Should I be a scientist in some way? I studying astronomy is a place I like. You know, you made me think about James Cameron. You know, James Cameron is a great artist, but this brother's be out here building submarines, and you know,
he's developing whole technologies. Yeah, and he's waiting stuff. To shoot movies, waiting until the technology comes into being. Yeah. Like, and he so has that me, much. Yeah. That's isn't that amazing about that guy? Do, he has so much faith in what he does. He's going, I'm going to do a thing.
Right.
The technology's not here yet.
Yeah.
But I'm
so
going to.
If I wasn't an artist,
I
would be. I've always had a fascination with, you know, black holes and nebulas, you know, those kinds of things. I've always had a fascination with the ocean, with our rainforest and things like that. So, you know, I would be in the sciences in one of those fields. I don't know to what capacity, but yeah.
When you talk to somebody who's next level on that frequency, like the next question I'm going to ask you, I asked it to Neil deGrasse Tyson, and like,
love that,
he's
brother.
Like, yeah, he just, when he's talking, he's like, I could just, because I'm a big fan of Alan Watts, the philosopher, I could just sit there and listen to him for hours. And I can listen to Neil deGrasse Tyson just pontificate on things going on. How do you think about that? You know that, but the question I asked him, I'm going to ask you, is if you had that DeLorean, you can go back in time, you're 16 years old.
Shoot.
And to where you go meet 16-year-old you for a few minutes. And you get a piece of advice to give to yourself to make that moment a little bit better, or maybe get yourself in a little bit different trajectory. Mm. What would that piece of advice be for you, for younger you?
I would say start sooner, have less fear. I would give them a book called Letters to a Young Poet by Rainer Maria Rauch that talks about, you know, tunneling inside yourself. I would tell them, you know, it's a delicate balance you have to have. You have to not give a rusty about what people think, but then you do have to give a rusty about what people think, but it has to be the right people. You know what I mean? So that's the balance. And I would tell them, just start writing right now. You got the juice. You got the juice, boy. like you got the juice. You don't got to be a gangster rapper. Write what you want to write. Just like write what's in your heart. And there's a space for you if you create that space. And so many times we're trying to exist in a space that was created for someone else. And that was never your lane to be in, and people find it, like, you know, speaking of Neil deGrasse Tyson, ain't really no brother like this brother. He's smart as a whip, but he fly, he got swag. If you watch Cosmos, I was like, who is this brother? That's the reason I know about that bees are a democracy, because I watched Cosmos. And I'm watching, and I didn't. So you got to find your own path, bro. Everything is about finding.
You know what? I love that, and kind of expand on that. One of those things, and even as an adult, I learned is like, oh, there is no template. No. You know, it's like that thing of like, you don't have to, because other people have. It's, you kind of go through a little bit of like that first renaissance in your life. You're growing up, you kind of realize, you know, your early 20s or whatever. And then when you're like later on past 40 or whatever, you go, you know, I can do whatever the hell I want to do. I don't, right. You know, you start with to put it bluntly, when you get that, I don't give a fuck, you know, yeah. You know, that gives you freedom.
It does. It's a catch 22 though, man. Always, like I said, you got to give a fuck, but you can't really give a fuck. It's one of them things where I think you just need to have a tight circle around you. Cause when certain people, mm-hmm. they can help you, I think that constructive criticism is important. The building up of someone, you know, the building up of yourself, believing in yourself, self-awareness, you know, you got to know, like I said, what you're good at. And what you're not good at, like I was never going to be in the NBA. It wasn't going to work for me. You know what I mean? So, yeah, man, I would say less fear and stop paying attention to these girls, man. They going to be there. They going to be there, man.
Dude, especially if we ever 16. Have a chance to. We could have a whole other show about it. But yeah, with Neil deGrasse, but funny on that question, Neil deGrasse Tyson was like, you know, I wouldn't change anything. Why would I, you know, he kind of pontificated. I saw where he was going with it, but he's kind of like, it's kind of like where you're at. If you like generally what this was, you know, you kind of, it reminds me, there's a movie back in about 1990 called mm-hmm. Mr. Destiny with Jim Belushi.
Jim Belushi.
And he was like, you know, what if he got that touchdown in high school? What if he, you know, and then put him on a different trajectory. But it's like he didn't realize how much he appreciated what he had then. Right, so if you take one piece out of your whole life experience, you know, it's that whole thing about if time travel existed, you know, the butterfly
effect. You know, yeah, one thing changes the next thing, or maybe you get it sooner, but then you can't handle it then. You know what I mean? Maybe you go faster, and then now the hit show or the hit book or the wife or, you know, whatever is at 25, and then you're not emotionally ready yet because you wasn't, you know, seasoned to be able to handle those things. So
I think a slow build, I learned this early on, a slow build is so much, you build much more solid of a foundation than when you, somebody who rockets up really fast.
Yeah.
You know, there's just something sustainable. But
real quick on this thing, for anybody who listens to this, it's never too late. This idea that it's that, you know, you're 40 or you're 50 or you 60 or you 70 and you can't go do the thing that you want to do. You can. You could go paint. You could go start a business. You could become an astrophysicist. You could become a zoologist. It just takes you breaking the chains and doing it. And I think that's the most unfortunate thing I hear now, as, you know, my friends are getting older, you know, aunts and aunties, they speak as if their life has passed them by. And I'm like, bro, you 55, man. Like, what you mean? You could be on this planet another 50 years, man. You can go do if you want to do it.
It's so funny you say that, because I'm at that spot now. Like, I'm going, what do I want to do? You know, when my youngest graduated high school and, you know, I was like, I can leave Louisiana because I want to be there, you know, until they were done with high school. And I go back out to Southern California. I was like, I don't know. I'm like, down here on this island, what I call my tropical Mayberry. Right. With like 3,000 full-time residents. But I mean, we just had spring break, which is just pure insanity. But we got an airport. I can go anywhere I want. But here it's kind of like gives me that headspace. You know, it's not there's a lot of noise. You know, like you talk about, like you have a garden. I think when you're gardening, you get same thing when I'm on a beach, you know, you're more clear. You kind of like, what do I want to do? And sometimes you know, it can change. I'm like, I'm trying some new things right now. You know, it's like, I found when I did my show, and I used to have a syndicated radio show on ABC and ABC radio, and I could only chat with people for like 5 to maybe 15 minutes. I'm like, no, I really enjoyed the story, because everybody's got a story. And I think that, like, that's what poetry, that's what all arts do, is they tell a story. I'm like, that's what turned me on. Then this genre that we're in right here, this didn't really exist back then quite the same way. Mm-hmm, now it gave me the opportunity. I was like, okay, this is where I was kind of, you know, this, and, you know, I do voiceover and I'm like, I enjoy just spending time with my kids and my dog when I, you know, that's kind of like, yeah. I'm, you know, and just kind of waiting for the next inspiration. So, but yeah, my friend, it's been such a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed spending some time with you, more than you know, and
likewise.
But yeah, definitely going to check out. I'm just kind of cracking into Cross. And I saw how you liked, I you had hot sauce in your French fries. I think that was a thing.
That mama sauce, yeah.
So I'm sitting there going, it's like, this is a guy I got to talk to about food. This guy's serious. Well, man, go have yourself a great weekend and try, you know, enjoy a little downtime. I'm going to go make my trip to go get my ramen at some point in the next couple hours.
Enjoy that thing, man.
Well, my friend, I appreciate you more than you know. And hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up down the line.
Hopefully, man. Stay blessed, stay beautiful, and have a great weekend.
All right, there you go. That's Johnny Ray Gill. Man, I enjoyed that conversation. Just a different kind of guy in all the best ways possible. You know, he's kind of that Renaissance vibe. You know, you meet those people occasionally, and they're always great for a good cup of coffee or beer or a sit down and just kind of see where they're coming from. Get you inspired, make you want to try new things and just kind of experience life in a little bit different way. You know, that's kind of what I enjoy so much about doing this, having these conversations besides hanging out with you, is sharing these thoughtful folks who come and share bits and pieces of who they are. So enjoy Johnny Ray Gill and great conversations to come. So make sure you have subscribed to Story and Craft. Follow, if you will. Make sure to like the episode, whatever podcast app you use. Leave a comment. It does help people to find the show. Also, storyandcraftpod.com, the website, everything's there. Past guests, everything you could possibly want to know. And also, we are doing it on Substack. Just go to storyandcraft.substack.com. Really embracing the Substack vibe. It's really cool if you, you know, of course, follow Story and Craft on Substack. You get an email every time a new episode comes out, a little notification, and we have cool things coming soon. So I'm going to get on out of here, and I want you to have a great rest of your day, evening, morning, afternoon, whatever, weekend, whatever you're doing. And as I always say, and I do mean it, I really do appreciate that you make whatever I've got going on here part of what you've got going on. It does mean a lot. So take it easy, treat yourself well, and I'll talk to you next time, right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation, right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.